today I'm going to talk about building F-sharp microservices and reactive user interfaces with WebSharper. So this is almost like a getting started into F-sharp and WebSharper. My name is Adam Granitz. I have a small company called IntelliFactory. There's my Twitter handle. If you're interested in looking up, following my tweets, please do. I get a kick out of that. I'm a six-time F-sharp and then .NET MVP. So I was in the first batch of F-sharp MVPs, even before they had the F-sharp specialization. So for 1 year, I was a C-sharp MVP, even though I rarely have used C-sharp. And I'm a co-author of 5 F-sharp books. So I'll have a slide on those books in a second. So I just wanted to tell you up front that you are in good company. Because we're going to be doing functional reactive web development in a functional language in F-sharp, which is really something that is nowadays buzzing. You know, functional reactive development and functional programming in general is just basically everywhere nowadays. So regarding our little tool here, WebSharper, it's basically has been out for a number of years now. We have just passed 90-some thousand downloads. It's basically a whole ecosystem. So if you read the abstract of the talk, it talked about WebSharper not as a tool, but as an ecosystem, or an ecosystem for web development, functional reactive web development. And indeed, it has over 50 plus extensions and other libraries within this ecosystem that helps you, or help you basically develop different kinds of applications, providing bridges to different other JavaScript technologies. And then it's all open-ended, so there are tools and other things within the ecosystem that allow you to bridge into other JavaScript libraries as well. I'm one of the more active community members in this WebSharper thing. I've given over 60 talks in 30 plus cities, and I have been to Prague before, naturally, to give a talk, so this is not a new city for me, but I'm thrilled to have been over in over 20 countries giving talks about WebSharper and F-sharp in general. So, okay, let's see what we have for today. It's actually quite a lot, so I'm going to be picking up some speed here. So first, we warm up and we kind of look at the motivations of why we would want to do this functional reactive web development as opposed to like doing ASP.NET or PHP or JavaScript coding or whatever. And then we're going to take a deep dive into WebSharper. We're going to look, first of all, at what kind of resources we have to actually learn WebSharper and what kind of resources we have to kickstart development projects and take examples from other people. So sort of like what are the paved roads that people have walked on before, meaning how you install, what kind of project templates do you get, like what is the overall state of things. And then we're going to dive into the microservice examples, because this is one of the main topics for today, like to demonstrate that how easy it is to actually build microservices with WebSharper. And then we're going to look at producing not just responses in general, but also HTML responses. And with that, we're going to look at single-page applications and multi-page applications, and then full-stack client-server applications in F-sharp. And the second part of the talk is going to be about the reactive development topic. I'm going to introduce to you UI Next, which is basically WebSharper's UI Next, or a reactive extension, so to say. It has a component for dynamic data flow definitions and also reactive DOM and presentation layer and connecting the two, including templating and so on. And then we're going to have some quick examples, the usual to-do app that people do with reactive frameworks. We're going to have some data charting, and in particular, this is one of my favorite areas of interest, we're going to be looking at functional user interfaces. Formless, flowless, biglets, all the good stuff. All right, so here are some of the books that I had the pleasure of co-authoring. The Expert F-Sharp 1234 is with Don Syme, who's the designer of the language, as you may know. And then we had this wonderful Visual Studio 2010 .NET 4 book. So hopefully you have all these books, but if not, please get them. So a couple of words about our company, IntelliFactory. It was founded in 2004. We are based in Budapest, in Hungary, and we do basically F sharp stuff. 99% to 100% of just about everything we do is in F sharp. We do consulting, training, and development. In particular, web development and mobile web development as well. And we, next to this kind of consulting, we also develop technologies for other developers and other software companies. So we have this kind of a B2B setup as well. And then we work with web and cloud technologies. But if I had to sum up, like, in one sentence, what is the thing that we're most proud of, or what is the thing that we really specialize in, it would be basically building full-stack F-sharp enterprise applications. So, you know, companies or a bank comes up and says, well, can you guys build a, I don't know, an internet banking application? And we would say, sure. And all the code we would deliver at the end of the assignment would be all F-sharp. So no JavaScript, no C-sharp, no PHP, no ASP.NET, nothing. Just F-sharp. Sometimes we hand over entire projects by giving one single file and saying, here's all your application, including client and server side. So for a lot of people, this is unimaginable. I mean, some people even go at the crazy length of coding server side stuff in JavaScript instead of actually thinking about the right way and maybe just going from a high level abstract language and producing JavaScript automatically and just not using JavaScript, which is said to be a terrible language. I don't quite agree with that, but a lot of people don't like it because of the low-level stuff and all the crazy quirks that you can do as a dynamic scripting language. But it has its places. It's definitely the most ubiquitous language that we have nowadays, so you just have to deal with it. So our strategy is, if you can't beat it, at least just try to make a friend with it. And so right now, that's what we're doing. We made F-sharp a friend of JavaScript. Alright, and here's just some numbers about our company. So we have, by now, about 300 F-sharp projects. About a good 60 of them are open source, which actually total means that it's one of the largest F-sharp code bases in globally, basically. We've built over 30 commercial applications using this technology that I'm about to present, and F-sharp together. So that's about the numbers. Let's talk about the motivation, why we want to do this. So first of all, web applications are just about everywhere now. You know, 10, 15 years ago, there was this big craze about moving all the thick client applications to thin client applications, basically meaning that instead of desktop installable applications, we now want to have this desire to just go and open up a browser and go to an address and access these applications without having to install anything. So they are everywhere. But developing them is still overly complex. We have to deal with a lot of languages. If you take typical projects, PHP on the server side, JavaScript on the client side, HTML for representation, for markup, SQL for data access. So in a typical web project of any size, probably medium and above, you're dealing with 6 to 8, maybe even 10 different languages within that project. And the resources needed for this, like client-side developers, server-side developers, database developers, they don't speak the same language. So if I have a team of 10 developers, I am constantly hit by the communication overhead and the communication bottlenecks that I run into because these people don't speak the same language. Not just programming language. They have absolutely no desire to learn about the other's stuff. If I'm a server-side developer, I don't want to learn about the quirks of JavaScript or the quirks of SQL. So what we're trying to do here is to push all of these different things into F-sharp. I can do database development in F-sharp, I can do server-side development in F-sharp, I can do client-side development in F-sharp. So soon I can take 2 or 3 people's jobs in my team, and I can just do them without having to wait for anybody. And thus, I'm eliminating these bottlenecks, and my projects are becoming faster, and I'm writing less code, and it's all more understandable, more maintainable, etc. So, to sum it all up, what we want is to change this status quo that exists nowadays, and we want to have more development productivity. And we want to do that by basically pushing as many things as possible into a type-safe functional language, in this case F#, and we want to distill certain functional programming abstractions to model the different pieces in this puzzle, so to say, and then make these abstractions and the tools and everything, the whole ecosystems, very widely available and easily available, and thus sort of trigger an industrial adoption, which has largely have taken place already. I mean, if you look how many companies are using functional programming or F-sharp, you see definitely a sharp increase in the probably the last couple of years. All right, so about WebSharper, it's the largest F-sharp web ecosystem. As I said, it has quite a number of downloads and a lot of users, companies, people using these different extensions and the main toolset itself. Basically, it has a lot of different use cases. It's not just for compiling F-sharp to JavaScript. It's probably just 20% of this ecosystem is the compiler that does that. But we also have tools that basically cater to full stack client server development, or if your forte is single page applications, then you can do those. Or if you want to have HTML applications, meaning it's basically a client side application that doesn't have a server side or doesn't consume any services, but you still don't want to use JavaScript, you can write those as well, all in F-sharp. It does have an F-sharp to JavaScript compiler, but it's not what WebSharper is. And it also provides these different web abstractions that I'm going to be briefly touching upon, and then you can sort of get an idea of what kind of power this represents. It's an open source project since a number of years now. It's available on an Apache license at that GitHub address, and we definitely welcome code contributions. We have, I don't know, about almost 2 dozen active contributors to WebSharper and all the different libraries that we have, which, like I said, is at least 60 different open source projects, just like WebSharper itself. All right, so just in one slide, if I had to tell somebody what is the biggest advantage of using, for example, a web framework like WebSharper, it would be this. It would be basically representing the server and the client side parts or tiers of my application within the same code base, in the same language. So here is an F-sharp file. It can be even in the same file. You define two different modules, server and client. They don't have to be defined in two modules or segregated. You can just keep them, all these functions interleaved, one is server side, the other one is client side. But you do need to annotate the functions at least. And in one of the cases, you have to say that this is a remote function, and the other case, you have to say it's a JavaScript or client side function. At that point, for example, if your client-side function calls your server-side function in F-sharp, that's just that's a simple function call. However, underneath, when this code is pushed through the compiler, we actually generate the communication. So this actually issues something like an RPC call. And the communication, as you notice, I can define functions that take arbitrary amount and type of parameters. And indeed, I don't have to be restricted to, I don't know, SOAP envelopes and, you know, certain types that can be passed from the client to the server. There's no such thing. Here, everything can be passed. And that's one of the other advantages. There's a whole, I usually run a couple of slides on like why you would want to use WebSharper. I purposely omitted those slides this time. But the other things that I always mention is that you get automated resource tracking. So if in your F-sharp or WebSharp replication you happen to use jQuery or some other JavaScript library, you only have to open that namespace. And if you use any artifacts that would trigger the dependency on the JavaScript library, they would be automatically included in the actual source or the target code that gets generated. So you don't have to worry about the dependencies. You can write all your code in F-sharp. You get these wonderful abstractions that I'm going to show you that help you to type safely and robustly represent your web application pieces, and you get a bunch of other advantages. You can interact with virtually any JavaScript library, and that's pretty much it. It's a lot of advantages, and a lot of heavy ones. So how do you get started with WebSharper? So first of all, when you download WebSharper, it's available as a plugin for the main IDEs, including Visual Studio and Xamarin Studio. When you install these plugins, you basically get new project templates. So from an outside perspective, you have a little installation, which is, let's say, for Visual Studio, would be a VSIX file that you download from our website. you install, and suddenly you go to new project, and then you get a WebSharper section underneath with a bunch of templates. The other way of obtaining WebSharper is using, for example, some tool like Yeoman. There's another derivative Yeoman-based generator F-sharp tool. If you have the Node Package Manager, you can install Yo, and then you can install generator F-sharp, and at that point you just say Yo F-sharp, and then you will get a dialog that says what kind of WebSharper project would you like to have, or other F-sharp projects as well. And then, of course, we have an online ID that we also built with WebSharper. It's called CloudSharper. I'll have a couple slides on it. It's basically another way of using WebSharper without even installing anything. You just open CloudSharper and then you can start your next WebSharper project. I'll talk about TryWebSharper, which is another site, in just a second. Let's just cover the project templates first. So when you see the available number of project templates, they may be overwhelming because you get like a dozen different templates. You may wonder, like, what is the difference between an SPA and an HTML application? What is a sitelet-based? What is a UI Next? So basically, to break this down in an easy way, there are two different things. There's UI Next and there's WebSharper HTML. And they are the two different main representations of how you can represent HTML content. One, the UI Next one is a reactive HTML, which means it can have interesting functional reactive pieces that are two-way bound with some data model. And then in the other WebSharper .html representation, you basically just have plain HTML combinators that allow you to construct HTML markup, but they don't have reactivity. So we have single-page applications, we have client-server applications, and we have HTML applications, and they're all both, or all three are available in both flavors. And there are other kinds of other application templates as well, like hosting a sitelet on Suavi, or hosting it, or self-hosting it. So basically you can start a WebSharper project, and then at the end you get an executable file, and all you need to do is just run the executable, and then you can go to an address and you can already get served this stuff from that executable. So there are all kinds of different deployment scenarios, from OWIN compliant containers, ASP.NET compatible containers, like IIS, there's self-hosting, and then you can also serve your WebSharper site that's using Suavi, which is probably the best F-sharp web server. All right, so let's look at the hello world. So let's say I'm building a microservice, and what I want is that my single endpoint, which is accessible for my microservice, should respond by the text hello world. How do I do that? Well, in this case, there's some formalities you have to define. You have to put your stuff in a module or a namespace. So let's say you do that, you give a name, and then you open the two main WebSharper namespaces. One is WebSharper, and the other one is WebSharper sitelets. We'll talk about sitelets in a second. Then you say, here is an application which is of type text. And all it does after receiving the context is it responds by saying hello world. And then you define that by an attribute on this binding, you say website, and you just compile this and you push it through the WebSharper compiler, which if you use the right project template, it's all automatic, so you can do control F5, and then this application will start to serve on a particular port, depending on your application template that you chose. If it's self-hosting, I think by default it's on port 9000. If it's an ASP.NET template, then it just gets served on a random IIS or built-in web server port. And when you go to that entry point, which is the root of the application, you just get the text hello world. This is not an HTML page. It's a text that says hello world. And the way I know that is because it says application.text. This is a textual application. It's a single endpointed application that responds with a string. Not JSON, not XML, not a date time, a string. So this is fairly okay. I mean, what could I do with this? For example, it could return the current time as a string. It could return my geographical location based on my IP address, or a number of other things. So it can already be used for some minimal service, but it's not ideal because it doesn't allow me to actually pass or retrieve structured content. it doesn't give me like JSON that I can parse according to my needs. And before we even look at that, let's look at what it means to actually define endpoints. So this application we saw here had an implicit single endpoint, which was the root of the application by default. You can change that, of course. You can give it a different endpoint if you change the type of the application from text to something else. For example, here, the notation is a bit weird, but basically here we have a multi-endpoint application which happens to serve a particular type. In this case, we define endpoint to be an int. And then what we said is we want to now define a website from this that takes the context, but also takes the endpoint type. And we just call it, let's say, endpoint. And then we match the endpoint and we see what we have. This is the parameter of my service. So we are saying that before we didn't have a parameter in the hello world case, it just responded for the only endpoint with the text hello world. In this case, we now have an int endpoint. And we can actually examine the int endpoint. And then we can return some other content. In this case, we are still returning text, which is a string. And we say, well, whatever number we have, and note that because I is the endpoint type, which is defined to be an integer, it is going to be an integer. It's not a string that I get as a request parameter, it's going to be parsed out as an int. Therefore, I can multiply it and make it the square of that parameter. I can string it back and I can return it as a textual content. So if you run this service, and if you go to the entry point, like localhost 9000 or just localhost, it's going to say 404. Because localhost is not the entry point or endpoint for this application. You have to pass in an argument. So you say localhost slash 1, and it will say 1. Localhost slash 3 is going to say 9. So this is now a minimal microservice that takes an int and returns some other value computed from that int. As you can see, it's a low ceremonial way. We're still writing 6-7 lines of code. Now we already have a fairly sophisticated microservice. And by the way, this is full and all-inclusive, the code. I didn't omit any details. That's all the code you need. So here's a slide that has the different kinds of entry points or endpoints that you can address automatically. Like if you see the int that we have been seeing in the previous example is just one of the most basic endpoint types. You can also have floats. You can also have other strings. You can have HTTP status codes, dates, and times. You can have tuples, records, options, lists, arrays, etc. So I can pass an array of tuples where one of the parts of the tuple is a date time and the other one is an integer and the other one is a string or whatever. I can basically talk to my microservice in an extremely unrestricted manner, but it's all type safe. So here's some sample requests. I can say slash none. That's basically saying I am just passing an option which happens to be unfulfilled, so it's a none value. If I pass 2 slash 1 slash 2, it's interpreted automatically as a list because we know how to parse this. And then the 2, the first number, is going to give us that, hey, this is some kind of container, either a list or an array, and it will have 2 elements. And the 2 elements are 1 and 2. Same for floats, same for strings, same for all the array cases. So that's the sample request. This is what we have to call from outside, like localhost slash 2 slash 1 slash 2. This gives us I just passed a list of 2 numbers. But when I actually deal with it in F sharp in my match case, I will basically have a representation for an int list or a string list. I don't have to parse or unmarshal or marshal anything. I don't have to do any kind of representational transformations. I get these values in the same type as I defined in my type system, which is extremely powerful. You can just imagine being able to pass a record like this, which is a typical way we pass, like multiple, either tuples or records, You say, here's a string and here's an ID. But the work behind it to actually make it a string and an int pair is overwhelming if you had to do it manually. Here, it's automatic. So, endpoints. Bottom line, it's very easy to pass stuff and retrieve the stuff you were passed in a type-safe manner. And you have all these different primitive and aggregate cases like lists and arrays and tuples and records. And naturally, these can be arbitrarily nested. So you can have an array of tuples of more composite types. All right. So now we can pass pretty complex stuff, and then we can return responses based on the complex stuff we pass. But what else can I do with these endpoints? And then we enter the realm of endpoint modifiers, which basically are further annotations on an endpoint type. So remember, here we had an endpoint type. We just said, it's int. Boom. But life sometimes is not that easy. Sometimes I want to pass like a discriminated union. So here I'm passing a discriminated union, but the union case only has one case. It's about. And all this stuff here is basically an endpoint modifier. And in this case, endpoint is an attribute. It says specifying the actual URL and the method that will be used to access this resource. So when I represent an endpoint like this, I will have to go to whatever my server slash about to trigger this entry point or endpoint. So as you can imagine, and we'll talk about these in a second, this is how you build multi-page applications. You basically define a bunch of endpoints and you say, this endpoint will be this, that endpoint will be that, and then in your match case, you're dealing with the discriminated union and not the request. All right, another endpoint modifier called query. Here we can say, some of the things that I'm passing to my service are gonna be coming as a query parameter. So for example, here's an endpoint. It's called document, and it has basically an int value that it carries, and it has an int option that it carries, and that will be called version. And then we say that I have an endpoint at slash doc, and the version will be passed as a query parameter. So basically, it will be like this, question mark, and then version equals one. And the way we know that it has to be version is because that's the name we gave in our type definition. So when I say slash doc, slash 1234, question mark, version equals one, this is the actual type that will be, or value, that will be extracted for the endpoint. Or if you say slash doc slash 1234, you're basically omitting the version, then you get none in the past value for the query. So once again, this endpoint modifier allows us to pass more complicated stuff and get a type safe request on the other side. And you typically are dealing with discriminated unions at this point. So you're already in the multi-page applications scenario. Here's another modifier. I really don't want to technically go into these. This basically is a variation on the previous one. Instead of passing it as a request parameter, you pass it as JSON. So you can say, I'm posting this, and I'm not defining it as a post. So I'm posting to slash create this JSON value, and I'm gonna get back this value for my endpoint. So the posted JSON is extracted automatically, and I don't have to deal with anything else other than just annotating my endpoint type, which is pretty cool. All right, and the last one is basically form data. This is the same thing. So this is yet another variation. Instead of a query parameter, and instead of JSON, we're passing certain things as form data. Which basically, in HTML, if you have a form element, you have a bunch of input controls, and you have a submit button, the stuff that will be passed onto the handler of the submit button or submit event is going to have a bunch of form data. Here, we can say, extract all the stuff that comes as form data into a type safe F-sharp value. All right, so now we have all the basics. I can define easily certain endpoints, even extremely complex endpoints, in just a few lines of F-sharp code. Let me just let the system deal with these endpoints. So now we can, of course, we saw how you can build basic microservices that respond to particular different arguments, and then respond with text or JSON or whatever. We'll have a slide here about like what else can we respond with in fact, let's just run that. That's too far away. We'll come back to this. So let's deal with SPAs. So SPAs are not a microservice anymore because they actually return some visible HTML content. So here, you note that instead of application.text or application.infer or site.infer, we actually use application.singlePage, which takes a function that takes a context, and then we have to define some kind of a result value that is going to be HTML. And there's an abstraction called content.page, which basically represents a skeleton HTML response. And anything we put as an argument to the constructor of this page, in this case all the H1 text hello world, that's an argument to the constructor of the content.page type, is going to be the body of the HTML response skeleton. So here we get an HTML file that has an empty head section and a body section which has an H1 including hello world inside. Essentially you get that. So that's already HTML. But you only had to write the body of the HTML, everything else. If this included some JavaScript code, which you will see in a second how you do that, and the JavaScript code relied on jQuery and some other JavaScript libraries, then the HTML page and its head section would have implicit link and source and all these other tags to bring in those extra dependencies. And you wouldn't have to do anything about that either. Okay. So this was a single-page application. Let's do a multi-page application. So I have my endpoint type. Let's say I have two pages in my application, a home page and an about page. The home page I want to be accessible at the root. The about page I want at slash about. So I annotated or I optionally set these up using the endpoint attribute on those two discriminated union shapes. So this is my endpoint type. And I define two functions, home page, about page, that returns some HTML response. And then my main sitelet is going to be an application.multipage taking the context for the serving context and the endpoint. We examine the endpoint. This is a discriminated union, so there are only two cases. And then you say, if it's the home page that you're requesting, then serve the home page. If it's the about page, then serve the about page. Now, these could have arguments, which we could have parsed out, as we have said, just by changing the endpoint type to carry, so home could say home of, and then you could say a bunch of things. Those will be automatically handled for you. But in this case, we just have a very simple application that happens to serve two pages. In fact, when you start the client-server WebSharp replication template, that's going to be the default application in it. So the home page is going to have a little interaction where you type in the text box some text, it gets sent to the server reverses the string and then it returns it, and then basically the client, after the RPC call returns, shows you what the server has returned. So it's already a mini server client application. And you can take a look at the code, it's like 50 more lines. I didn't want to put 50 lines in here, that would be too much. But you get the idea that you basically define how these are constructed. They can contain dynamic elements, so they can be entirely static, and you just return it from your site. All right, now let's look at something more interesting. So by now we have learned some really basic stuff about endpoints. We saw how really powerful they can be, and we have used these endpoints for basic microservices that take a single element or a composite data or list of elements. We saw how you can construct single-page applications, multi-page applications, etc. But we haven't seen anything really cool yet. So there's a URL in the bottom of this slide. And if everything goes right, that's the first example that I have. So before we jump into this, let me introduce this Try WebSharper. So basically this is another site that you can use to sort of try out WebSharper in a dynamic way. You don't have to install anything, just go to this address, try.webshopper.com. And basically what you see is there's a few featured examples. Remember, this would look a lot different, except I have like a VGA resolution here, so everything is like squashed into something tiny. I have a way to filter out certain snippets, and I have an incrementally growable list of snippets here. And there's like, I don't know, 100, 200 different snippets you can play with. So this is the site, and then when you pick one of the snippets, like in this case I picked one, you will basically get a two-way split screen where you have the code on one side, and then on the right-hand side you have the actual output from that code. Except when it's small resolution, then the output, the result, is going to be tagged as another tab. So I have to explicitly click that tab to show you this. Normally you should see something like what I have on one of my slides here. So you have an editor that you can freely type into, and then on the next side, on the right hand side of it, you basically see the result of that webshop replication. Alright, so let's look at this. So this is my World Bank example. Let's say this is it's a pretty large application, 106 lines. So if you go from the bottom and build our stuff, what happens is there's a main function which basically constructs a few things. Construct two charts, it constructs a legend, and it constructs a small little chart, and above it will say tertiary school enrollment, and it will add it to a tertiary enrollment placeholder, and then there's some other stuff which gets added to another placeholder. So what the heck is that? Well, the answer lies in the index.html file. This is the skeleton of the application. So this is one particular type of an application. We actually call this a bundled application, or basically just a single page application. That's the name of it. A single page application is driven from the single page, a single index.html page, which has certain references. In this case, it has some static stuff, and it has two placeholders, these two divs here. And those are the divs that will be populated by content by the JavaScript file that gets compiled from this F# code. And once we get to running this in JavaScript, then whatever we have computed for chart one will be concatenated with this H4 tag, and it will be added as a dynamic content generated into the placeholder. And similarly, there's another chart populated the same way. And how are these charts basically retrieved? Well, there's an asynchronous call to the World Bank database, and then we do stuff. Let's look at the World Bank database first. So there's this line here. It's basically a type provider invocation. So F# has a pretty advanced feature called type providers. Type providers basically have a special F# syntax. In this particular case, the syntax lies in the fact that we use these not curly brackets or parentheses or braces, but we actually use the angle brackets to pass arguments to a type. And what happens is that that type, with those arguments, is going to invoke its own builder, which is the type provider. And that type provider is going to basically return a new type space injected into the type that had been defined. In this case, type World Bank equals the type provider invocation. Then the next line is going to have World Bank dot and a bunch of stuff that had been generated and put there into the type space by the type provider. So when I, in the next line, I say World Bank dot get data context, that get data context had been dynamically generated for me as a member, but it all happens statically. So if I go here and see what's get data context, my hover comment says what the exact type is. And let me play with this a little bit. So these are my countries. And then for each country, we map from its indicators. Let's just see what else we can have. So let's say we do a dot. Wait a little. Say I already broke the code. That's discovered. So I get these red squigglies. And then I get, you know, once I do code completion, I get all these different indicators that have been dynamically obtained from the World Bank database right at this instant. And then I can just put my whatever indicator I'm interested in. So let's say I'm interested in that. All the red lines go away almost instantly, just like if I was in Visual Studio. Remember, this is a tool we ourselves built with WebShopper. It's actually pretty cool. We use it for all kinds of things. most definitely to demonstrate the different capabilities of WebSharper. But here, I just pulled in all this data, and I'm basically getting a bunch of countries that I have defined above, and for each of them, we retrieve the school enrollment, and then we parallel obtain them, these values from the World Bank database, and then later on we chart them in certain manners. And then the result is going to be this. So let's say I run this. It's already pre-ran and computed for us, but here I ran it from scratch. And you saw that it took about 2 seconds. What this 2 seconds was used, we basically went out to the World Bank database. We dynamically asked for the schema of that World Bank database. We compiled on the server a new DLL, which contained all the type space. Then we took that as a reference to the code that we just saw and compiled the F-sharp code with the WebSharper compiler, which generated JavaScript, and we served that from the index.html linked. And then we get this. So if I want to change the title up there, I would have to go to index.html. If I want to change the number of countries that I'm plotting the data for, I would have to change the F-sharp code. And we already changed the F-sharp code, and we saw that if you change it in the wrong way, things will break. Like if I remove Hungary, then we just broke Hungary, and then there's the red light, which says, I don't know what the hell Hungary is. See? And code completion, oh, there's Hungary. And now you can compile and then we'll run again. So, that's it. Alright. And it's pretty interesting actually to check out all these different trends in the World Bank database. It's actually cool. But this example is about just picking a random data source and being able to interact with the data source in F-sharp on the web without doing anything. How much time do I have? About
2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. So let's run. So there's all these pages, some of these pages we saw already. There are different notations for representing HTML using UINEXT or WebSharper HTML. I'm not going to go through that. Sitelets, they represent web applications. Responses, they give you JSON, plain text, you can serve files, you can get error codes, HTML content, etc. Pretty simple stuff. And now the reactive web development part with UINEXT is based on a paper, which is right there. This is our research paper from a couple years ago. The idea is very simple. You have some code which maintains a state on the client, and you have a visual representation of that state. For example, in this case, a text box, and they're two-way bound. So if I change the value in the text box, it will update the value of the view of the variable. And if I change the variable, it will update the actual UI element. And then you have a stream of these changes, and there are RX and different FRP systems that basically give you the foundations for these. We have our own system, it's called UINEXT. Here's an example. If you see the result, it's something very simple. I type something and underneath it says capitalized. Here's another example that basically if I type something, we compute different views of the value that I type. One is the original view, this is the capitalized view, this is the reverse view, this is how many words it has, and here's the word count, odd, or even. And all of that is basically just very simple mappings of views. So if you go here, you have my original view, and then I all caps it, I reverse the string, I count the number of words, I match that to even or odd. And then I basically put all that in a div. This is basically compiled on our server and returned to you as JavaScript. Yeah, but it's running on the client right now. If I change it and I compile again, compilation takes sometimes half a second, sometimes 2 seconds, depending on what kind of complexity you have within your snippets. Now, these snippets can call arbitrary different JavaScript libraries, and here are some of them that you can include as references. As you can see, this one actually uses UINEXT, but you could have used React or PhoneJS or Material UI or whatever you want. If you want charting, you can have probably 10 different charting libraries here. These are the standard WebShopper extensions in our ecosystem that I mentioned. Alright, these templates, so we have reactive templates, so a designer can give you a design artifact, like a template file, and you can basically consume that from just a couple lines of F-sharp, and you can have reactive elements embedded into the template automatically. So if I have an application like this Studio application, I can tell my designer, hey, can you please change all this, I don't like the look and feel of this, he will give you a different index.html and probably some style sheets inside, and all you have to do is recompile your application and it will look different. And here is basically 40 lines, and I can add a new task, I can remove tasks, I can cross them out as selected, and all of this is basically the typical to-do application, and in our case it's 40 lines exactly. I have to rush through here. So reactive sitelets are basically used for client-side routing and SP. This is pretty advanced. The other things that I probably don't get a chance to talk about is basically reactive and declarative user interface specifications for formats to reactive formats, flowlets, and piglets. Piglets being the most capable and the most valuable in real practice. And then from basically a reactive piglet will be what we call in our libraries webshopper.forms. So here's a login form. I think, no, this is a first name and age form. That's all you have to have. You define basically an input for the first name, an input which inputs an integer unchecked as the age, and then the bottom it says submit. And then you basically have this one here. One is basically using WebShopper forms with an arbitrarily UI library, let's say in this case Bootstrap. The code looks pretty much the same. See, all you use basically is a different controls that instantiate the actual look and feel, but the formlet itself, or the piglet in this case, is exactly the same, and then the result will be quite nice, because now I can say, well, my username is Granitz, my password is Granitz. And then when I log in, I get a pop-up that says, welcome, Granitz. And all in, like, what, 25 lines. And now, of course, you can imagine that you can build a library that builds user interfaces like this using Kendo UI, Sensual Touch, jQuery Mobile, jQuery UI, Bootstrap, MDL, Material UI. You name it, we have it. And that's pretty much it. And I just want to show a couple of slides, basically this Cloud Shopper stuff. This is what it looks like. It's an environment that I showed you. I have it running here. So I was doing an interactive session here, just doing a charting. So basically, all I did is I said, so we get to look at this. Here's some stuff. Run this snippet, and basically, there's a pop-up that comes up, and the code executes, and then you have a chart. And it's all instantaneous. And this is basically used for interactive data visualization and stuff, and this is the last slide I have. If you don't like any of these options to get started with WebShopper, you also have integration not just with Visual Studio or Xamarin Studio or Cloud Shopper or Try WebShopper, but there's Atom, and here's a plugin that basically automates all that, and you install it, and with just a few short commands, you can basically get started with WebShopper apps. Thank you very much, and here's some Twitter handles and some URLs to check out. Please do, and let us know how you like it. Thank you very much.